Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for November 9th, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, high-energy cosmic rays from outside the Milky Way galaxy, how the behavior of a group of whiteflies makes it more invasive, and choosing the landing site for the next Mars rover. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
They come from outer space. The highest energy cosmic rays in the universe, first detected in 1962, appear to come from outside the Milky Way. The scientists of the Pierre Auger collaboration have concluded that the source of these rays, now a decades-old mystery, appears to be active galactic nuclei, which are the compact centers of galaxies that host giant black holes and are thought to eject vast plasma jets into intergalactic space. I spoke with the team's corresponding author, Antoine Letessier-Salvon, from his office at the Laboratory of Nuclear Physics and High Energies in Paris.
We have now the certainty that the highest energy cosmic rays are coming from outside of our galaxy and are connected to the local universe and the local matter distribution in the universe.
What are these cosmic rays exactly?
Well, this is a good question. Since they've been the very highest energy cosmic rays, the first ones they were discovered in 1962, the ones that we call really extremely energetic, and we aren't sure yet of what they are. They could be protons or heavy nuclei like iron, but the question of exactly what they are is not totally settled. What we know, though, is that they're not in majority photons or neutrinos, for example, and they may not be exotic particles. So they may be things as simple as heavy nuclei or protons, but one or the other is not yet determined.
Why is it so hard to tell? Is it because they're traveling so fast? How fast are they traveling?
Well, they're traveling at the speed of light, so they're traveling extremely fast, but this is not what makes it difficult to know what they are. It's because they're extremely rare. There's one cosmic ray at those energies that strikes the Earth every century over a surface of 1 kilometer. So there is no way we can study them directly, that is, have a small detector in orbit and wait for a cosmic ray to pass by and measure it. There's just not enough of them. So we have to install huge detectors on the surface of the Earth, and this is what the Auger Observatory is. It's a detector which is installed over 3,000 square kilometers, which is a pretty big chunk of land. And we see a few of those cosmic rays every year, but we don't see them directly. We see the trace they leave in the atmosphere. So we see the cascade of particles that they produce in the atmosphere. We don't see the original cosmic ray directly. And because we don't see it directly, it's difficult to tell exactly what it is.
So this detector is detecting particles or the cascade of particles that are created, and that separates them from the one that was detected in 1962, which was a direct measurement?
No, the one measured in 1962 was also measured indirectly on the surface of the Earth with one of the first large ground ore I ever built, but it was only a few hundred square meters on the surface of the Earth. So it's the same detection technique. What now the observatory does is that we have combined several techniques, and we have a very, very large aperture, 3,000 square kilometers, as I said. So we are able to record several of those extraordinary events per year, and not only one every a few years. Before Auger, there was only about 10 events of that size, or 20 events of that size, in the whole data set recorded by all experiments before Auger. And now with Auger, we have doubled that statistics in only a few years, and we'll go on adding more events to our sample. And with more events you have, the better you can understand them and the better you can trace down their origin and their nature.
So how exactly do you detect these events?
So the detection is fairly simple. When the original cosmic ray enters the Earth's atmosphere, it will interact with the nuclei of the atoms of the hydrogen or oxygen that are in the air. And it will, in fact, totally convert its energy, its initial energy, which is enormous, enormous cascade of particles. So one particle with very high energy at the top of the atmosphere creates a billion of particles on the ground with a billion times less energy. Of course, energy is conserved. So, and all those particles, they go through the sky. And so we have two ways of detecting them. When they go through the atmosphere, they produce excitation of the nitrogen, and this excitation produces visible light. So if the night is dark and very clear, and if you have good telescopes, which we have, then you can see this small light produced along the trajectory of the original cosmic ray produced by the cascade. And then on the ground, when the particle reaches the ground, we have put detectors that will see those final particles when they get to the ground, and we see them because when they go through water, they will also produce some light, and we have what is called water Cherenkov detectors on the ground. It's essentially pure water with light-sensitive detector, and when those particles at the end of the cascade enter these pure water tanks, we will see the light they produce and record it.
Okay. So the Cherenkov radiation, that's that same blue glow that you can sometimes see in a nuclear power reactor because the particles are passing through something
exactly
much faster than
the speed of light in that medium. Exactly. This is exactly the same radiation, and it's produced by the same particle. What you see in a cooling pool of a reactor are the electrons that are coming out of the rods, and when they get into the water, they produce Cherenkov light. And essentially, at the end of the cascade, what reaches the ground is electrons, photons, and muons, and all of those particles produce Cherenkov radiation in the water.
Now, with this enormous grid and of detectors and these air showers, is it some geometry and statistics to figure out the direction that they came from based on which detectors these air showers hit first?
Absolutely. So we have, in fact, in each of those detectors, there are 1,600 water Cherenkov detectors on the ground. Each of them is spread apart by 1.5 kilometers on the triangular grid. And each of them is equipped with a GPS receiver, which is placed in old position mode. That is, the receiver, in fact, only serves as a clock. But it's a very, very precise clock. Each of our detectors is synchronized with each other at better than 10 to the minus 9 seconds, 10 nanoseconds. So using the information of the arrival time of the particle in each of the detector, we can do a triangulation and find the original direction of the cascade, which is directly the original direction of the cosmic ray. And from this, we can, of course, trace back the direction of the cosmic ray in the sky.
Now, out of these high-energy cosmic rays that have been observed or detected with the Auger Observatory, how many of these do your algorithms suggest come from outside the Milky Way galaxy?
Well, we've recorded a good million of events above energy, which is small for Auger, but still pretty big for cosmic ray, which is of the order of 10 to the 18 electron volt, or less than a tenth of a joule. And out of those, we are really looking now at the 27 most energetic ones. And out of those 27, 20 correlate in the sky with structure of local matter, but local in the sense of the universe, not in the sense of the galaxy. It's really extragalactic, but still relatively nearby. That is within 100 to 200 megaparsecs times 3-4 light years.
Wow. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Antoine Letessier-Savant is the corresponding author of a paper by the Pierre Auger Collaboration that correlates the highest energy cosmic rays with extragalactic objects. Read more about it in this week's Science. Also this week in Science, talking sensibly to machines.
No, this isn't a story about machines talking or, in this case, reading sensibly to humans,
but about how a machine can understand sensible human speech. In a perspective in this week's Science, Yorick Wilkes explains that advances in research may lead to human-computer conversations that could be used to help astronauts on long voyages.
Like the computer, Hal, in the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey.
That's right, computer.
Thank you.
Or assist elderly people in recovering their memory through conversation and images. Read the perspective, Is there progress on talking sensibly to machines?
I hope so.
You'll find the perspective in this week's Science. White flies. They're one of the world's worst invading pests, killing crops in a variety of ways, including the transmission of a virus. Now, in a paper published online this week by Science, Xusheng Liu and colleagues have analyzed the behavior of a particularly invasive variety of whitefly and found that the fly's behavior itself is what makes it such an invasive species. It's the first time such behavior in insects has been observed. Both males and females of this variety get stimulated to mate more often with one another by the presence of males from another whitefly variety. I spoke to Liu from Dejing University in the People's Republic of China.
We have discovered a behavior mechanism that tells us why this pest could be successful in invading new territories and displace native close relatives, then become very destructive to the agriculture in the invading region.
Now, does this invading species, it's just displacing a similar species that was doing the same thing to the crops, or is this particular invader doing something more?
It's the key point. The native relatives, they are displacing, actually, usually are relatively innocuous. They're there, but they normally do not do damage to the agriculture and the environment.
Just what sort of damage are they doing, this invading species?
Well, the worst damage they do is by transmitting the viruses. A group of viruses called the Bergamo viruses is the worst plant viruses in the world. It causes very severe epidemics of tomato, tobacco, and cotton, and many other crops.
Where did the invading species come from?
Well, this is a question many scientists in the world in the last 20 years have been trying to find out. According to the latest research finding jointly done by scientists from the States, Australia, they found the invading pest, what we call the B biotype of the whitefly, most probably has the origin in the Mediterranean and Asia Minor region. That's the best scientists can make so far. And they have been invading all parts of tropical and subtropical in some of the temperate regions of the world.
And where did your data come from in studying this invasion?
Well, it's one region in eastern China and also the Queensland, Australia, so from the two regions.
Okay. Now, when we're talking about the invasion here, we're talking about one group of whitefly just outbreeding the other, is that right?
Yes, yes. The whitefly is scientists still trying to figure out the species status of this organism. In this group, it has many genetic groups that you can't distinguish them by morphology, but they actually do not interbreed each other. So this B biotype is a particular genetic group, as we know, or we can speculate so far, it has the origin of the Mediterranean and Asia, Minor Asia region. It has been spread to much of the rest of the world.
Okay, so even though they couldn't tell the difference perhaps from one another, they were not able to breed with the native species?
At least not with the native populations or what we call genetic groups we have studied so far.
Could you tell us then a little bit about how whiteflies breed?
Yes, we could say they are haploid, diploid species. Haplodiploid actually is fairly widespread in insects and some other arthropods. They have a particular mode of reproduction. If the eggs are fertilized, they what we call the diploid, then they develop into females. If the eggs are unfertilized, then they would develop into males, and that's called haploid.
Now, did your data reveal something about this particular species of whitefly that made this invasion so quick?
Yes, I think that's the most interesting part of the study. When we did the field sampling, we found there's changes of sex ratio in the invading and the native population. Now, we found when the invading and the native individuals come together on the same plants, the invading individuals, they mate more frequently and they have a higher rate of egg fertilization, and consequently they produce more females for the next generation. And at the same time, they also interfere with the mating of the native individuals. This is because they are closely related and they have some similarity in their mate recognition system. So in this way, they can interrupt the reproduction of the native individuals and reduce their rate of egg fertilization and also the production of female progeny.
And that's because the haploid diploid characteristic means that the invaded species females who are having sex with the invading species are not going to produce any female eggs because the mating would not be successful, so they'll only produce more males?
Yes, for the individual population, because their mating is interfered by the invading males, so they get a late chance to mate, so consequently they have a reduced rate of egg fertilization, so they produce more males and less number of females.
Well, that sounds a bit like the invaded species had something to do with it too, in that their males were not populating with the females of the invading species. Is that right?
Well, the native males, they do not interfere with the mating of the invading individuals, or very little. In fact, the presence of the native males in the colony would stimulate the invading males to court the invading females more frequently. And the invading females also tend to accept courting and then mate more frequently with the invading males. In this way, they achieve higher rate of egg fertilization and for the production of more female offspring in the next generation.
So they could somehow tell that there were natives around, and that just made them more interested in having sex with one another. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the females played a major role here. The female, when they sense there are more males around, they tend to accept more courting events from its own males. So in this way, the presence of the native males actually helped the invading male and females to mate more frequently and to stimulate the reproduction of a invading population. So this is actually something that has not been recorded or found for any other insect species or organism.
So the ratios of females to males went up. There were more females in the invading species and more males in the native species because of this haploid diploid.
That's right. That's precisely what it happened. But the asymmetry can happen the other way around. The native organism type also can be the stronger one. In that case, it would have to prevent invasion.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Xuxing Liu is lead author of a paper on the asymmetric mating interactions that drive the whitefly invasion and displacement of native varieties. Read more about it online at www.scienceexpress.org. Other mating behavior research in this week's Science: female spadefoot toads breed with other species. Karen Fennig reports in a paper her research on the female spadefoot, which switches mating behavior based on the shallowness of the pools in which the offspring will develop. Because the spadefoot's tadpoles develop more slowly than a closely related species of toad, the female spadefoot will mate with the other variety and produce hybridized offspring. The hybridized offspring are more likely to survive because they are more likely to have developed enough to survive by the time the shallower pools dry up. Read the paper, Facultative Mate Choice Drives Adaptive Hybridization, in this week's Science. NASA's next rover to Mars will be twice as long and three times as heavy as the Mars exploration rovers Spirit and Opportunity, be more powerful, and carry more instruments, including instruments to help it identify the basic building blocks of life, as we know it, such as amino acids and proteins. But where on the red planet should scientists send it to land? Senior science news writer Richard Kerr reports on it in this week's issue.
In late October, a group of planetary scientists met in Pasadena, California, to consider just where they might want to send the next rover to Mars. Where on the planet will be the safest and most interesting scientifically?
Why is it so important for NASA to get that kind of input?
Well, it's these people who have the deepest understanding of just what Mars is like, as incomplete as that is. So NASA wants to send their next rover to some place that's going to really produce major results. And for that, you need to know something about the place you're going to set down.
Are the scientists who are choosing these landing sites, are they pretty pleased with this process? And where are these scientists coming from?
These scientists are volunteering their time and their effort for the chance to direct where the next rover is going to go. It's been a very democratic and joke-filled process, as it happens. They were generally pleased with the way things are going, with the caveat that they know don't have a perfect record as far as picking interesting sites. And so they're being a bit cautious. But the prospects are good, I think.
Are the scientists coming from all over the world to help make this determination?
The participating scientists come from primarily the U.S., but there were Europeans in attendance. They have fresh data from their Mars Express orbiter. It's very broadly based.
Is this going to be a really expensive project that NASA is considering, or is this something going to be more fast, cheap, and out of control?
This is one of their larger efforts. It's going to cost overall $1.7 billion. That's twice as much as the total cost for sending and operating the two rovers that are still roving around Mars today, several years after their landing.
Will this be just one rover then that's going?
This will be one. Two went last time, but it's much in the culture of NASA to make the next mission bigger and better, presumably, than the one before. So this is a massive rover. It's loaded down with instrumentation, and it's going after a new target. NASA has, in the past, sent rovers to follow the water on Mars, to look for those places where, at least in the ancient past of Mars, there was water and therefore possibility of life. This time, they're following the water, but they're following that to find, as well, organic matter that might be lingering from past life or conceivably even present-day life.
Twice as much for this one project, bigger and better, might be better served by going to visit four sites with four rovers.
Well, most planetary scientists will concede that they'd just as soon have two more of what they sent last time. And there's plenty of places to look on Mars that are different than the ones they've looked at before. The planet has a surface area the size of the land area of Earth. So NASA has landed five times successfully on Mars. Three of them landed in very similar places, fields of lava rock. The last two, one really hit pay dirt on a flat plain that billions of years ago was water-saturated ground. The other rover that's still operating landed on what they thought was a lake bed but turned out to be another lava plain. It eventually went on and did find some water-altered rocks, but there's still plenty of new and different places, many of which were discussed at this workshop on the basis of some very new data that's been returned from Mars.
So the site selection committee really doesn't have much of a say, if any, as to what the rover will be. They'll just be choosing the spot or helping to choose the spot that it'll go.
Right. This process takes planetary science communities' input as to where the rover should be going from a scientific point of view. NASA has already decided what's going to be sent, and it's big and heavily laden.
So where is this new data coming from that they're using to help choose that site for the new rover to land?
The latest and most powerful data is coming from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which NASA sent to Mars last year, began returning data last November, And so everybody was flashing up their colorful images and spectral data. So scientists had a lot of new and very fresh information. Some of it they'd only seen the week before.
So as they're whittling down the sites that they choose, they'll be spending more of this Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter's time looking at those particular sites in order to say for sure, yep, we're landing in some place we're interested in rather than a plane full of big boulders?
Yes. The workshop's output was a list of 6 places on Mars. So Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter will be looking for rocks that are too big to land a rover on, slopes that are too steep, looking for more signs of interesting minerals that might have been altered by water in the past. And that's going to be ongoing the next 9 months when planetary scientists will come back, look at what NASA and the Mars Science Laboratory people have gotten together for them, and come down to a single site that they feel is going to be interesting and safe.
Is there something about this rover that will make it more able to land safely? I mean, presumably, they've improved some of their engineering.
This lander and its landing system is entirely new. And in some ways, it's more capable than the rovers that have gone before it. It's going to be landed, targeted to a much smaller area. So they can target an area of interest and avoid dangerous areas nearby. And it's going to be pretty exciting in that this rover is going to be lowered from a raft of rockets onto the surface, the cables cut, and the rockets go flying away out of the way. In another respect, it's also more capable. It's nuclear powered. It has a so-called radioisotope generator on it. And so it doesn't have to depend on solar power the way the current rovers must. And the rover is equipped far more capably than the current rovers. Probably the distinguishing capability is that it carries a mass spectrometer. And this is an instrument that can extract chemical compounds from a sample and separate them and identify them. And so this is the primary way they're going after the organic matter. No rover has had that capability before.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Senior science news writer Richard Kerr reports on choosing the site for the next Mars rover. Read the article in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news service, Science Now, joins us for our usual roundup of other recent stories. Hi, David. What do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, I've got 3 cool stories for you. We're going to talk about how Paris Hilton relieves pain in mice, how your diet can disrupt your body clock, and finally, about a new planetary system out there that looks a whole lot like home.
Paris Hilton relieves pain? Tell me, how did this experiment begin?
Well, this is a really interesting experiment that's coming out of the Society for Neuroscience meeting that just took place in San Diego this past week. And what researchers noticed, or they have noticed, is that when mice lick their wounds, which is an indication that they're in pain or that the wound is causing them pain, they seem to stop licking when scientists are present. So researchers wonder, is there something about people that causes mice to forget their pain? And they wanted to know whether it was the sight of people or the smell of people. What about people it was?
Enter Paris Hilton?
Enter Paris Hilton. The researchers at McGill University in Canada ordered a cardboard cutout of Paris Hilton from her TV show, The Simple Life. And what they did was they placed the cutout in front of mice who were licking their wounds. And what they found was that when the fake Paris was present, the mice spent less time licking their wounds.
Was it all mice that found Paris to be such an analgesic?
No, it was just males, perhaps not surprisingly. Male mice spent less time licking their wounds when Paris was present, but females didn't. And what's more, male mice expressed less of a protein that seems to be involved in how the spinal cord relays pain to the brain. So not only were the male mice spending less time licking their wounds, but on a molecular level, they seem to be experiencing less pain when Paris was present. And the females didn't exhibit any of these effects.
If I were a mouse, I don't think having a large human standing over me would make me forget about my pain. Is there something else going on here?
Well, what the researchers think is happening is that Paris is actually stressing the mice out. And by being stressed out, they are somewhat forgetting their pain, and it may also be activating molecular cues that cause them to forget their pain. And one could imagine, in an evolutionary sense, if you were stressed out or had to get away from a predator, which mice view humans as, that you wouldn't want to be spending time worrying about pain. You'd want to focus on other things. And researchers think that might be what's happening here.
But more so in males than female mice.
Right. And that's something scientists are still trying to figure out. But it does add to a growing body of evidence that suggests that males and females react differently to stress. So this is just one more example, albeit a very entertaining one.
Well, from the stresses of seeing a predator to the stresses of eating too much fat, what's going on there?
Well, this next study concerns the idea that eating a high-fat diet can disrupt our body clock.
The circadian clock?
Exactly, the circadian clock. And basically how the circadian clock works is it regulates a lot of our day-to-day activities. When we go to sleep, how long we sleep, even how much we eat and when we eat. And scientists knew that if we somehow disrupt the clock, it would disrupt some of the cycles we have, our sleep cycles and our eating cycles. But they didn't know if the opposite was true, whether eating certain diets could disrupt the clock. So they wanted to test this in mice. So what they did was they fed a group of mice a high-fat diet for about a week. And lo and behold, the mice experienced disruptions in their circadian rhythms. They were a lot more restless when they should have been sleeping. And although most mice don't eat a lot during the day, these mice that had been on a high-fat diet all of a sudden started eating a lot of food during the day. And what's more, they experienced a lot of abnormalities in genes and proteins related to circadian rhythms. They were at very different levels than they were in normal mice. So all this indicates that at least in mice, a high-fat diet seems to disrupt the body's clock.
Now, I've heard that obesity and lack of sleep were tied together in some way. Is that part of it and the late night raid to the refrigerator?
Well, this could definitely be shedding light on that. Researchers know that obesity, diabetes, and sleep disorders all seem to be tied together in some way, at least in certain people. And this is giving them further evidence that disruptions in the clock can not only lead to eating disorders, but eating disorders may lead to disruptions of the clock. So it's another nice piece of evidence for this puzzle.
Well, speaking of adding another piece to the puzzle, it sounds as if astronomers have figured out that there are solar systems like ours?
Right. Well, this story has to do with a very important discovery that was just announced this week by NASA. And this has to do with a solar system known as 55 Cancri. The name doesn't exactly roll off your tongue, but it's about 41 light years away. And astronomers have wondered for a while. They've found a lot of extrasolar planets up to now, and they find these planets that are orbiting their suns, and these tend to be these huge planets, and they're usually only about one of them.
Because they're finding these planets because of the gravitational wobble they're causing to their home star?
Right. Astronomers look at suns, look at distant stars, and they're actually able to detect slight wobbles in the star. And these wobbles indicate that there is a planet orbiting the star that's slightly tugging on its gravity. And by doing this, they've been able to find a handful of solar systems out there, but none of them really look like ours. Most of the ones they found so far only have one planet in them, and they're these huge planets, and doesn't really look like a lot like our eight-planet system that we have. That's what makes this new discovery so exciting. So in 55 Cancri, astronomers have been studying this system for 18 years, and so far they had found four planets orbiting the star, which is impressive to begin with. But the latest discovery is a discovery of a fifth planet orbiting the star, which right away makes it, besides our solar system, the solar system out there with the most planets. So already it's starting to look a little like ours.
Now, are any of these planets in the habitable zone? Close enough to be warm enough, but not so far away that they're too cold?
In fact, this new planet they found is in the habitable zone, which makes the discovery even more exciting, because not only do you have a bunch of planets now, but this most recent addition is in the habitable zone, which, although the planet is not really an Earth-like planet, it's about 45 times the size of Earth, and it looks like a big gas giant, probably similar to Neptune or Uranus, the planet itself probably doesn't support life. But if it had a moon that orbited it, that moon could potentially support life because it exists in this habitable zone.
41 light years is pretty darn far away. How are we going to learn more?
Well, as I said, they've been studying this star for 18 years, and the more they study it, the more they discover, and the better telescopes they get, and the more they modify the telescopes, the more they discover. So I think time will just tell. As they study the system more, they may find that moon that I was just talking about, or they may find other planets in the system that are even more comfortably within the habitable zone, because this most recent planet, even though it is in the habitable zone, is kind of right on the edge of the zone, and if they could find planets that are more squarely in the middle, they might be even better potential planets to support life or have moons that support life.
Far out.
Literally.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what stories are you looking into for later this week?
Well, we're looking to a story about why parents eat their offspring.
Ooh.
Another story about how a horror from the deep may have caused one of the planet's biggest mass extinctions. And finally, how hand grip strength gives clues to male fitness. So be sure to check out the site later in the week.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can check out the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the November 9th, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.